More than a decade ago, a young woman in her late 20s came to visit me one day at my office. A wife, the mother of three young children, preschool-aged children. I had known her for some years, but that day as she came into my office and we had the initial chatter of small talk, I was impressed by how great she looked. There was a bounce to her life, a vivaciousness to her voice. She was attractive and pretty. She looked as good as I think that I had ever seen her. She got into the conversation by explaining to me that recently in her life she has been looking for some excitement and that she had gone on a program of exercise. She had lost weight. She has bought new clothes. She had had her hair changed. She had done a lot of things to make herself feel better and look better. And indeed, they had been markedly successful. But she sensed that there was still something missing. She lacked the excitement of life, and it seemed to her that her responsibilities at home, her marriage, were rather dreary and lackluster. So, she told me, a few days earlier, she had gotten a babysitter one evening when her husband was at work, he having a job that required a particularly unusual schedule that changed frequently, and she went out to a local Italian restaurant for dinner by herself, sat at a corner table and ate her spaghetti dinner by candlelight, finished the meal, paid the check, and was about to go out to the parking lot and drive home when she instead decided to go into the bar and have a few drinks before the evening concluded. She sat at the bar alone until a stranger came and struck up a conversation with her. They shared some drinks together, and after a bit of time, he asked if she wanted to dance at the dance floor that was in the bar that was part of that Italian restaurant. By her own description, in that moment, she had a strange and kind of good mixed feeling of fear and excitement, something quite unlike what she had ever experienced before. And so she rather readily said yes. And for her, the next few hours were some of the most exciting and thrilling of her life, the kind of experience that she was looking for. She felt young, pretty, important, desirable. As the evening progressed, the man spoke lovely compliments to her, kind things. He was particularly considerate. He said, although they had only known each other a very short period of time, that he sensed he was falling in love with her, and they were amazed at the things that they shared in common together. He said that he wanted to see her again, that he wanted to go to bed with her. She was frightened, and she said no, went home, but was flattered when the next day he called and asked if it was possible to set up a time, a place, when they could again see each other and again could be together. She stalled him, said that she would think about it, that she would get back to him. And it was shortly thereafter that she came to see me, told me this story, and I guess sort of asked my counsel and advice as to what she ought to do. Now, as I heard her out, I tried to understand her situation. I tried to empathize, to identify with her and the circumstances in which she found herself. I listened as she described her marriage, but reflected back to her that, all things considered and in comparison to many another story that I have heard about marriages, it was really relatively good. That which she sought was not so much in reaction to that which she had at home, but that which she had as a hollowness within her own life. I reminded her that she had a good thing going. She had a fine husband and a nice house and lovely children and a circle of friends, part of which were Charlene and me. That she had a Christian commitment, that she had told me and told others that she knew Jesus Christ as Savior and sought to be his disciple. I told her that if she were to allow further contact with this new found friend of hers, that she might jeopardize all that she had and in the process hurt a lot of lives. But most of all, I told her that she was considering premeditated sin against God. Well, she laughed. And I sat at my desk and swung the chair around and watched out the window as she walked down the walk away from the building and out to the car and then drove down the street until she was out of sight. And as I watched, I tried to analyze in my own mind what kind of communication had taken place. And I concluded that she really had been open, that she had heard me out. It was not as if I was talking to someone who was not listening or who was completely unresponsive. She was indeed weighing the alternatives. But I also recognized that she was enamored of the man that she met at the bar, that even then she was dreaming about his touch. She was rehearsing the words that he had spoken to her, and that she was beginning to imagine that the potential benefits far, far outweighed the potential losses. Now, I didn't see her again for about a month, although through some other channels I did hear some of what was happening in her life. When she next came to see me, it was simply amazing all that had happened in such a short time frame as a month, almost as if a major part of a lifetime had been condensed into 30 days or so. She updated me and explained that she had indeed surrendered to the temptation, that when he next called, they had set a time and a place and since then had frequently rendezvoused at area motels. She told me that she had fallen in love with him, explained that her husband had quickly found out, although she had not been particularly careful to keep the information from him, that he had already begun divorce proceedings and that at her own initiative she had agreed that custody of the children would be surrendered to him because, frankly, she didn't want to be tied down. She wanted the freedom to enjoy all the aspects of her newfound relationship. The next time I saw her was several months later. And although there were a lot of things that had occurred that I cannot here tell this morning, let me tell you that when she came into my office that next time, the bounce was gone. She looked years older. It almost seemed as if every month had added a year or longer to her age. She sat down and before she ever spoke a word, the tears just flowed, flowed. Finally, she got her composure, I think more from being cried out than anything, and then blurted out in staccato fashion the final part of that chapter of her story. She explained that her lover had left her, that she had no place to go, she had no money, she had alienated all of her friends. Her husband wouldn't speak to her except through an attorney. Her children were gone. And that her relationship with God was broken. What she experienced firsthand was why God gave the seventh commandment that says, "You shall not commit adultery." Now, I don't know what you expect from a sermon about adultery. I suspect that the stereotype is that the preacher ought to stand in the pulpit and hold up a big Bible and thump it, and that there ought to be all types of warnings about the revenge and vindictiveness of God, that there ought to be threats about getting venereal disease and AIDS and terrible things that will happen. And admittedly, I suppose I know that there are elements of truth to all of that. But I think it not the right approach. Not because there aren't elements of truth to it, but because I think, frankly, that misrepresents God's intent in the seventh commandment. And such an approach smacks at least of the hint that adultery is really a fun and happy thing to do, and that God is some type of celestial spoilsport who withholds that pleasure from us, who fences us in so that we will not experience all of the joy that can be ours if we will jump outside of the fence. And the truth could not be farther away. And so, this morning, rather than expound the negative, let's extol the positive, seeing three purposes that God really intends to communicate with this seventh commandment, a commandment that is so short you needn't even bother to look it up there in Exodus 20:14. For it simply has the short and memorable words, "You shall not commit adultery." God's first purpose in giving that seventh commandment is to safeguard the home. Now, to understand that, I need to say something that comes with a high risk of misunderstanding. And it is one of those times where I feel I would either rather have you listen intently for the next several moments and understand what I'm talking about, or if your mind is given to wander, which I understand my mind wanders as well, then let it wander now and don't come in until the appropriate time, or else you'll get it all mixed up if you only get part of what's said. Understand that adultery is not primarily a sexual sin. Now, in order to explain that, let me make a comparison. In the popular press and increasingly in the counseling and legal professions, it is being understood that rape is not primarily a sexual sin. Our society is beginning to understand that rape is primarily a crime of violence against another person, much as beating someone up with fists or using a gun or a knife is a crime of violence with a weapon. So rape also is primarily a crime of violence, in which the weapons are hands and genitals, but primarily a crime of violence rather than primarily a sexual crime. Now, in similar fashion, adultery is primarily a sin against marriage and only secondarily a sexual sin. There are many ways in which a husband or a wife can commit a crime or a sin against the marriage relationship. It can be done with money. It can be done with words. It can be done physically with abuse. And it can be done sexually with adultery. Adultery is primarily a sin and a crime against the marriage relationship, and only secondarily a sexual sin or a means for that violence or crime to take place in the marital relationship. Also, it's necessary to understand that the seventh commandment is not a general prohibition against immorality. In our childhood catechisms, we may have thought it that way. In fact, we may have even had it explained to us that way, as if to think that the seventh commandment is primarily saying, don't be immoral. That is not what the seventh commandment is saying. The seventh commandment is not a prohibition against sexual relationships between unmarried persons. The seventh commandment is not primarily a prohibition against homosexual relationships. The seventh commandment is an order for a married person to have sexual relationship only with the person with whom the other individual is married. It is an order for the married person never to have any type of sexual liaison with anyone outside of the marriage. That includes a heterosexual relationship, a homosexual relationship, that includes incest, and that even includes intent. The purpose of all of this is to safeguard the home. You see, absolutely nothing is as damaging to marriage and to family as is adultery. It leaves a breach, it leaves a hurt and scars that are just extraordinarily difficult to heal and to repair. And even when a marriage does survive adultery, and even when forgiveness is sought and forgiveness is granted, the memory, the hurt, the harm is never completely erased. Now, if one side of the coin is that adultery is not primarily a sexual sin, the other side of the coin is that fidelity, faithfulness, is primarily a spiritual commitment. The marriage relationship is much more than a legal contract. Now, a lot of people think of that way in our society. So you go to the county seat, you go to a county office here in Hennepin County, or if you live in Ramsey or Dakota or some other county, then you go to the place where the license is issued. And then you have someone who is registered with the state, like a pastor, who says a few words and goes through a ceremony and signs and seals the certificate. And then a legal contract has been brought about. when you take a look at Scripture, you really can't find anything quite like that. Because the biblical view is not primarily that of a legal contractual relationship between two people. Rather, in Scripture, marriage is seen as a covenant that is made not just between a husband and wife, but a covenant that is made with God. That's why Jesus said in Mark 10, "Those whom God has joined together, let no one put asunder." He does not speak of the husband agreeing and the wife agreeing. He is saying that which God has joined together, that which God has agreed to, let no one break asunder. So there is a sense then in which marriage is primarily a spiritual commitment to God, and certainly not primarily a legal contractual agreement with the state. Now, let me make an analogy here. I had someone tell me recently they don't think that I can think any way other than with analogies, and forgive that. Although that reminds me of... No, I won't do that to you. Some years ago, when I received my first passport, I was a college student and was involved in an overseas study program in Europe for the summer, and went to the passport office in there in Chicago and went through all the procedures. When I got the passport, I did what most people do when they first get their passports. They open it up and look at the picture and see what I thought of myself. And having got past the picture, then you may think I'm naive because I didn't know what all was in there. I started to read it and I found some things that I never expected it to say. That particular passport said that it wasn't mine, which I found marginally offensive since I had applied for it and since I had paid for it, but it said that it was the property of the State Department of the United States of America, and that if need be, I would have to surrender it to its rightful owners, which was the United States government. Also, imprinted in the front of the passport was a letter that was signed by the Secretary of State, a letter, you know, one of those to whom it may concern type of letters, indicating that the bearer of the passport, Leith Anderson, is a citizen of the United States of America, and requesting that all foreign governments accord me protection and transportation and access and all of the things that our government asks of someone visiting in another country. Now, what that meant then is that was when I went through passport control or customs in the United Kingdom or in France or Germany or Belgium or Italy or some of the other countries that were visited on that study program, that it wasn't just a relationship between Leith Anderson and that country and that government. I was not there just as an individual. I was there as part of the United States of America. And dealing with me meant dealing with them. So that if I was treated illegally or I was treated inappropriately, they would not just be answering to me, but they would be answering to the most powerful nation in the world. Now that's the very point of what's happened with the Achille Lauro, or with the hijacked TWA jet, or with the retaliation of the Reagan administration against Libya and Muammar Gaddafi. It's saying that when you push one of our citizens off the deck of a ship, when you shoot one of our citizens aboard an aircraft, when you do something against a citizen of the United States, you're not just dealing with an individual, you are dealing with the entire country, the United States of America. Now, so it is with marriage. Husbands and wives are not just dealing with one another in their marriages. They are dealing with God Himself. And He is a far greater power than the United States of America. He is the greatest power in all of the universe. So that adultery is primarily a sin against God, because the promise to faithfulness is primarily a spiritual commitment and not a legal contract. You see, God's goal is for the family to be the basic building block of all of human society. That's why He wants to safeguard the home. The home is to be the means through which the human race is perpetuated physically and spiritually. And in order for that to happen, in order for God's dreams to come true, it's all tied into the safeguarding of marriage, family, and home. And for that to happen, adultery must not be allowed to destroy that which God has created. So God's first purpose in the seventh commandment is to safeguard the home. His second purpose in the seventh commandment is that those who are married experience God's design. There is one theological perspective which contends that the primary purpose of marriage is procreation, the birthing of children. I would contend rather vehemently from Scripture that that is not God's primary concern, although that certainly is part of the marriage relationship. And I would base that argument on what is taught in the early chapters of the book of Genesis. You recall that in the creation account, God came to the place where it seemed as if creation was finished. He had created Adam. But then God is quoted in Genesis 2:18 as saying, "It is not good that the man should be alone. I will make him a helper fit for him." So that it was only after God had created Eve, female as well as male, together, that he was able to look upon his completed creation and say, "It is very good," because they were together. Together for the primary purpose of companionship. So that together they were able to share and enjoy all that God had made in his goodness, including each other. They were to become the best of friends, and they were to be lovers. The marriage relationship was then designed by God in his ideal to provide a sharing of self and life not to be found possible anyplace else or in any other relationship. God intended in that ideal for there to be an intimacy of communication and commitment that would affect all of the rest of life, and that there be nothing else parallel to it. And there is nothing else that is parallel to it. Only in marriage can there be such a full and complete knowledge of another person, so that only in marriage, in that intimate relationship, is it possible to say, "I know someone else, and someone else knows me." It's in marriage that this happens, only in marriage, that we can be loved and accepted and understood, even though the other person knows things about us that others could never find out. Only in marriage can we truly be ourselves and be loved so completely anyway. Now, all of this is possible within the context of an irrevocable commitment that glues the marriage together. This is obviously, then, why there's a problem with those who, I think often with good motive, contend that they ought to live together before they're married. There are those who say, and I believe them, that they hold marriage to be so good and so important and so permanent that they dare not lightly enter into that relationship and so must first live together until they find out if there, in fact, is a compatibility. And if the compatibility is there, on the basis of that information, they will then make that irrevocable commitment. But they misunderstand what marriage is. It is not an experiment. It is a commitment. And it is only in the context of that relationship that that intimacy can be discovered. It is only when protected by the irrevocable commitment that it becomes possible to really know and to really be known. So it is a futile effort to live together to find out what it will be like if an irrevocable commitment is made. It can only be experienced in the context of that irrevocable commitment. This ideal that God has given to us is joined together in sexual union that is a unity then, a union together of body and of soul. So that sexual intercourse is more, much more, than a physical act. It is also a spiritual union. That means, then, to be held and to be loved and to be joined together with someone else who loves and accepts and is permanently committed to me is to experience God's ideal design for marriage. Charlene and I have a plaque that is on our bedroom wall next to the door that quotes Ephesians 5:31, saying, "The two shall become one." That's God's ideal. What you say? We live in a real world. A real world in which, unfortunately, the ideals often do not work. We live in a world where the problems are legion. We are constantly bombarded with satanic lies that there is greater satisfaction elsewhere. We are told, or we imagine ourselves, that marriage cannot possibly work. It just simply can't happen. And we live in a world where we are constantly exhorted to get what we can out of life rather than give what we can to others. We discover in this real world that we are married to men and women who have blemishes, inadequacies, sins, faults that are terribly pronounced. And sometimes within the marriage relationship, maybe off times, we discover things that we had never before anticipated. For where we thought that there would be tenderness, instead we find toughness. Where we anticipated that there would be love, instead hatred raises its ugly head. Where we thought, where we hoped that we would have forgiveness, instead we discover that there is revenge. We had dreamed that there would be hope and hell, and instead we have experienced hurt. Hurt that often comes in a relationship where it does not any longer take a paragraph of words, but simply a glance, simply a syllable, because we're known so well that we can be devastated so easily. And so, in the real world, we begin to readily reject God's ideal. We say it can't happen. And once we have mentally rejected God's ideal, then we are on the pathway to culminating, to consummating the rejection in adultery. And adultery becomes the harshest and the cruelest blow against God and against one's spouse. But there is a better way. Indeed, there is. The better way is to define marriage as a spiritual commitment to God. To see that there indeed will be problems along the way. There have been for every other couple, and that God anticipated that. But the problems are not meant to throw us apart. That God can and will use those problems to bring us together and to glue the relationship tighter than ever it would have been before. We need to understand in the context of that spiritual commitment that marriages have seasons just like the weather. That there is not just perpetual summer, but there also comes winter. That there is not only the budding of spring, but there are also the difficulties and harsh winds of fall. It is then that we need to trust God to grow us together, to glue us tighter as we face the fires and fears of life in what clearly is a tumultuous world. It is then that we can discover God's ideal and live it in the real world, where we can find a sexual relationship that is brought to a new level of ecstasy and fulfillment by facing life's struggles together. And so that enhances the intimacy, that deepens the friendship, that increases the bond. We can learn that commitment to God and one another can get us through the worst of times, the most horrible of experiences, things that alone we could never possibly endure, but together, together with God and husband or wife, it is possible to not only survive, but to be victorious. And when love in marriage begins to wane, it is possible to experience God's ideal as he relights the fire and he makes it happen again and produces a love and a commitment to one another stronger than ever would have been if the problems hadn't come. And then at the end of life, when we've lived our 70 or however many years, then, having experienced God's ideal in the real world, we look back with delight that we have done it God's way rather than having been thwarted by a broken commitment. The purpose of the 7th commandment is first to safeguard the home and second to experience God's design. The third purpose of this 7th commandment is to exemplify Christianity. This past week, I did some extensive reading on the marital and sexual practices of the first century Roman Empire. To those commentators who say that we live in the worst of times and the most immoral of times, my counsel is that such persons should spend a day in a public library and do a bit of research on the Greeks and the Romans and even the Jews of the first century. And I would suspect that that would change the tune of those that think that these are the worst of immoral times. Did you know, for example, that prostitution in the first century was not only legal, but that it was religious? that while we say that we come to church, to religious gathering, to praise God with hymns and with offerings and with prayers, in the first century, particularly in the Greek religion, people would go to the temple and worship God by having sexual relations with prostitutes, male as well as female prostitutes. The most important city of all of that was Corinth. Corinth, the city to which the first and second epistles to the Corinthians are written. The temple at Corinth regularly kept 1,000 prostitutes on duty. In fact, there and elsewhere, the primary fundraising method for building new temples was through the receipts that were received from prostitution. It was a time not only of rampant prostitution, but also of widespread homosexuality, far greater than what we read about and perceive about today. Famous leaders, the kind of people that we read about and study about in our schools, people like Socrates and Plato and Julius Caesar and Augustus Caesar, were all practicing homosexuals. In the first century, the leadership was so committed to homosexual practice that the historians tell us that 12 of 13 consecutive Roman emperors were practicing homosexuals. And it wasn't just homosexuality on the ordinary plane. Some of their perversions were so stunning that they would blow the minds even of people who are commentators on such things today. For example, adult men who were interested in their homosexual ways would recruit and often buy as slaves young boys for their liaisons. But they were troubled as the boys grew older. They wanted to keep them softer and more feminine. And so as those young boys would reach ages of puberty, they would emasculate them. And not only that, but they would, as their beards developed, pluck out the whiskers until they were gone. They wouldn't allow the boys to go out in the sunlight for fear that it would cause wrinkles on their fair skin, and they insisted that they wear makeup all the time. And it wasn't just prostitution and homosexuality and perversions, but divorce was far more prevalent than that which we have today. In fact, so much so that there were points at which it was so easy to get a divorce that there was almost no legality to it at all. Husbands would routinely dump their wives. It came to a point in Greece, particularly in the upper classes, where there was no legal procedure at all. A man would simply throw his wife out. Extramarital affairs were not looked down upon. It is not something that was whispered about. It was perceived to be something that was normal, something that was natural, something that was expected and even good. All of this led to the point in the first century where marriage in some areas, especially Greece, practically came to an end. There was almost no one, again, particularly in the middle and upper classes, almost no one that had a monogamous relationship of a man and a woman, and it came to the place where moral anarchy and promiscuity became the norm. Now, it was into that first century milieu that the first church was born. It was into that first century that the New Testament was introduced, with teachings that were as stark and different from the practices of the day as could possibly be imagined. For the New Testament taught a one-man, one-woman lifetime commitment to each other. Nobody was doing that. Nobody even thought of doing that. The New Testament taught sexual purity. That was the expectation of the church. The New Testament condemned adultery in a society where adultery was commonplace. The New Testament church and the New Testament teachings were in the starkest possible contrast to the morals of the Roman Empire. And then, as if that isn't enough, it almost stretches the imagination beyond where it wants to stretch when we open up our Bibles to Ephesians 5 and see that the Apostle Paul, in order to describe the relationship between Christ and his church, said, "Look at the marriage relationship between a husband and wife." It was almost ludicrous to say such a thing. And yet he said, if you want to see the way Christ loves the church, if you want to understand the way the church is responsive to its Lord, look at marriage. Look at a Christian marriage and you can see the way it's supposed to be. Now what would you say are the chances of that kind of morality surviving when the people were outnumbered more than 99-1? What would be the chances of the church not being inundated by the promiscuity of the day? What would be the chances
of them having even the slightest of impact. Frankly, on human terms, if a bet was being placed, I would decide on the side of the empire and of immorality. But that isn't the way it ended. For within a comparatively short period of time, the Christians changed the morals of the empire. Until the teachings of the New Testament became the law of the land, and the ways of morality and marriage that were taught by Jesus Christ became the expectation and the norm. Now, if they could do it then, we can do it now. We who are disciples of Jesus Christ and are filled with His Spirit, we can obey the seventh commandment. We can demonstrate in our marriages and in our relationships what it means when Jesus Christ loves the church and the church responds to Jesus Christ. We can live the ideal in the real. So let's do it. Let's not commit adultery. Let's safeguard our homes. Let's experience God's design. Let's exemplify Christianity in our real world. Will you stand with me to pray? Our Father, I pray this morning for the marriages represented here in this room. And I ask your blessing and your protection upon them. I pray that where adultery is a temptation or a reality, that you will come in and that you will forgive and that you will heal this deepest of breaches. I pray that where divorce is being considered, that you will change minds and hearts. I pray, Lord, that where homes are at risk of division, that you will bring them together. And I pray that in the marriages in this room, in this church, the ideal may be seen, that we may see and the world may see what the relationship of Christ to his church is like.